we acknowledge that a profound shift has taken place in the Canticle of Brother Sun, that what has been up until this point a celebration of the cosmic elements found in nature takes a shift and finishes, climaxes with two stanzas that are of a very different character. All praise be yours, my Lord, through those who grant pardon for love of you, through those who endure sickness and trial. Happy are those who endure in peace. By you, Most High, they will be crowned. And all praise be yours, my Lord, through Sister Death, from whose embrace no mortal can escape. Woe to those who die in mortal sin. Happy those she finds doing your will. The second death can do no harm to them. Praise and bless my Lord and give him thanks and serve God with great humility. These two stanzas, as we recall, were written at different points in Francis's life, apart from the initial creation of the other stanzas that celebrate creation. The stanza about those who grant pardon for love of you was written out of the context of a power struggle going on in Assisi, in which the Franciscan community played a mediating peacemaking role between political factions, and was able to bring about a peaceful resolution to conflict in the town of Assisi. And then, of course, the second stanza was written just before Francis's death, and was a celebration of life and death as he faced his end. We're going to shift a little bit from the pattern that we've been proceeding with in the last few days of looking at the different polarities of Brother Sun, Sister Moon, Brother Fire and Sister Earth, and we're going to depart from that a little bit to get at the material today, perhaps abbreviating somewhat the discussion around our neighbor, and maybe spending a little bit more time on how it is that Francis was able to befriend Death and greet her as a sister. We really want to keep in mind, though, the question, is this the same inspiration that wrote and lived these last two verses? Is it the same inspiration that carries the rest of the canticle and inspires the rest of the canticle? Or is this simply something tacked on at the end that really doesn't quite fit? That's kind of one of the questions we want to ask ourselves. Francis, to begin with, brother, sister, our neighbor, and I want to just offer a couple of readings to you, and then perhaps a little bit of discussion before we move forward. But Francis was first and foremost a person for others, even before his conversion, and certainly after. His praxis, his practice of the gospel, was characterized by an exceeding courtesy, a very profound view of manners, of how we deal and respond to human beings. There was a sense of gentleness about his manner in dealing with all kinds of affairs, human affairs. And this was part of Francis's character even before his conversion experience. This was not an abstract love for humanity, but rather a concrete appreciation for the unique singularity of each human being. It was a very concrete encounter with the individual that Francis was able to carry out. There's a quote from Thomas Merton that I want to read that I think gets at the Franciscan genius, this ability to see into the heart of every individual. This is a quote that refers to an experience Merton had as he came out of a long period of solitude and re-entered the world. Then it was as if I suddenly saw the secret beauty of their hearts, where neither sin nor desire nor self-knowledge can reach, the core of their reality, the person that each one is in God's eyes. I think this was the penetrating vision of Francis, to be able to look into each person and to see that inner core of reality that's beyond the reach of distortion and sin and all that we are prone to as human beings, but to see that person as God sees that person. And he was able to translate that again and again in concrete encounters. But it's not just to see our friends or the people we find attractive. That's easy enough, I think. Francis was also able to look into the face of the most disfigured and peripheral human beings, and also see God. And this is a quote from one of his foremost biographers, Solano. "The soul of Francis melted toward the poor, and to those whom he could not lend a hand, he at least showed affection. Whatever he saw in anyone of want, whatever of penury, he transferred in his mind by a quick change to Christ. Thus, in all of the poor, he saw the son of the poor lady, and he bore naked in his heart him whom she bore naked in her arms." I think Francis was able to live in to make present the sense of the Last Judgment described in Matthew 25, where God says, "If you did not see, you did what you did to the least of these, my brothers and sisters, you did to me." Francis is able to instantly make that connection between the most disfigured, needy, demanding, irritable person, or poor person, or person making demands on us. He can instantly change, make that transformation, and see in that person Christ, Christ in need. I think that was a part of his ability to greet our neighbor.
Okay. I think this is something he had to learn. I remember reading how he talked about he was always appalled by the lepers, you know, in the community. And he was just terrified of them. And when he started his conversion, he saw some lepers, or a leper coming down the road, and knew this was a test for him. You know, this new faith was going to be real. He had to overcome that, so he wouldn't have been kissed the leper, and then he could feel his heart opening and, you know, the growing experience.
That's a very important observation.
It's like he wasn't born with
Christ.
You know?
We did last week, and when we were looking at Francis in relation to the poor, we talked about this central story and its importance to his conversion process of when he almost forced himself to kiss the leper. And we had an exercise in which a lot of us shared stories in which we have found ourselves in that situation of being challenged by the leper, being challenged by the person outside of our comfort zone who kind of threatened us, made us afraid, who repulsed us. And quite frankly, I think it's important to share the stories where we backed down from that we weren't able to maintain that encounter. But there in every story of stepping out of that comfort zone, there are probably 10 in which we, and God forgives us, we back off. But you're right, it wasn't just a gift that he had it for all time, for his whole life. I think Francis was also able to practice this love of neighbor and recognizing God in his adversaries. And Francis lived a very confrontational life, both with the world and within his own order. There were power struggles going on within his order about the direction and of the order and the disciplines they would take. And so he was one who was often in conflict. And Lisa shared with me a quote that we've been trying to find, which I think captures some of that Franciscan spirit of loving one's enemies or loving one's adversaries. It's a quote from Longfellow. If we could read the secret history of our enemies, we should find in each person's life sorrow and suffering enough to disarm all hostility. It's almost like if I could look at this person and creatively enter into their experience and see them, this person who is just evoking all kinds of anger and hostility in me, if I can imagine them as a child and the first time they felt abandoned, or the first time that they were betrayed, or the first time that they were left alone afraid, I can see that vulnerable sinner, that needy sinner in them that only needs compassion ultimately and is crying out for someone to understand them. I think so much of what is out there in the midst of a conflict, in the midst of struggle with our adversaries, is a cry for help, a cry for understanding, a cry to be touched and heard. And if we can only begin to hear those things which most push us up against the wall as cries for help. I think that's true in our work with children and teenagers, and it's certainly true in our work with adults, because we carry those wounded children and teenagers within us. One more quote that I want to share with you, that in terms of Francis and his ability to enter into conflict with gentleness and compassion, it's a quote from Archbishop Câmara of Recife, Brazil, and it's taken from, what's the title, Lisa, of the book?
The Desert is Fertile.
The Desert is Fertile. Some of you know it. It's a very simple quote. It says, and it's just a little flash, it says, "If you disagree with me, you have something to give me." And I can't live that. I am constantly in disagreements, and I always approach them as if you disagree with me, you are trying to take something from me, you're trying to move the attention away from you, from me to you, you're trying to undermine my authority, you're trying to... It's like if you disagree with me, you have a gift to give. I mean, it is so simple, and yet if we could just almost say that as a mantra, as we enter into, when we see ourselves entering into disagreements and controversies, and just say it over and over again to ourselves, if you disagree with me, you have something to give me. And I think that's the spirit of Francis and how we approach our neighbor in conflict. I think ultimately for Francis, all human creatures deserve respect and reverence, not because they stand above creation, but precisely because they are a part of creation. And this is what Francis practiced with his life, that all of creation is ultimately a thou, not just our in-group, not just human beings, But all of creation deserves that I-thou kind of encounter. Even inanimate objects, so-called, deserve to that reverence and respect of the thou, not treating them as its. And that's, it's not that the human beings are a caste above creation, but all of creation is sacred and human beings with it. Would anyone like to react or respond to any of the readings or any of their perceptions of Francis or their own experience before we kind of move on into the next one?
Well, I know as you were saying that with all creation, I have walked around our neighborhood a lot, and there is a lot of property that's rental where people will just come in for a year or so and then leave. And in the neighborhood, there was a pine, which I could see from my back window, which I knew had been there. I don't know the lifespan of a pine, but I knew it had been in the neighborhood probably before all the houses were rebuilt. And I just loved walking by it because it just reminded me of that. And someone came into the rental property that pine tree was on and for some reason decided to cut it down, I think to get more light into their property. And I could hear them working on it with the saw. And somehow a lot of the neighborhood kids got involved and there was a lot of shouting and exultation and joy as sections of it were brought down. It was like it was just piercing my heart because I didn't think they knew what they were doing. So in a way, I feel, I didn't think they knew that they would leave the property very quickly, but this neighborhood had been kind of a landmark, or this pine had been kind of a landmark in the neighborhood. And so I felt really saddened. I almost had to say, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing.
We met this older couple in a camping campground in New Mexico, and we were playing a game of dominoes with them in their camper late one night. And this grandfather's made this comment to me that how much he enjoyed his grandchildren. The one thing he tried to teach them was to talk to trees. And I laughed, I thought, well, that's kind of eccentric. But he went on to say that the most important thing I think I can give my grandchildren is a reverence for trees and for all of creation. And if we can only get at that by being foolish enough to have a conversation with a tree, then let's do it. They're, somehow that actually incarnates that, though, actually engaging a tree in conversation.
Stuart, with all these days of concentrating on St. Francis, I'm seeing in my mind again the paintings by Giotto, the 13th century artist. And anyone who isn't familiar with those paintings, go back to the art book section in the library and the early Christian art. It's beautiful.
Wonderful transition. I was just going to make a comment about those paintings, the Renaissance paintings, Giotto and Bellini and others. If you look at the depictions of Francis, very, very powerful portraits of Francis. And again, they embody this Franciscan paradox between one who revels in life and in creation, and one who is in this very solitary encounter with death. You'll often see in a portrait of Francis a skull somewhere in the picture to the side of Francis. You'll often see him at the entrance of a cave, almost like he instinctively, as we know, was drawn to caves, spent many hours of retreat in caves, trying to come to terms with the secrets of the grave and to face that reality, even as he lived. But that skull that is in so many of the paintings reminds me of the Buddhist monks who contemplate, whole meditation exercises where they contemplate themselves in the grave. And this, I guess this strike, this at one time and in some ways still does, strikes me as morbid. And I still struggle with it. On the other hand, I feel like we cannot really live life now unless we are open to this part of life, which is death. Life and death really are a unity. And if we are repressing our awareness and knowledge of death, we have, in effect, cut off one half of what is life, what is human existence. They're so wed together, and everything is a coming and a going, a being born and a dying. They're a unity, and so to repress or neglect one is to neglect the whole. And so I think it's not morbidity to contemplate our end or to engage in this dialogue with Sister Death, if we can call her that. It's an important way to know what life is about and to live life joyously.
Stuart?
Yes.
There's a wonderful book called The Education of the Little Tree. And there's a wonderful section in it when this old friend of the family, an old Indian, isn't present in church one day. And so the grandpa and Little Tree go off up the mountain to find him. And he's dying, and he says, "I knew you would come. I waited till you came." And he gave him instructions, and he said, "Basically, plant me under the big tree out in the woods, because then I can nourish the tree, and more seedlings will grow." And it's just a very holistic way of looking at death, and calls to mind our very peculiar burial practices. Mm-hmm. Almost like plastics on the ground, you know, we never
buy or degrade. I want us to share and talk a little bit as we feel willing to. I mean, some of our encounters with death and dying. Perhaps we can begin, though, and just simply look at the way Francis approached death and how he died, mm-hmm. and his dying the good death, I think. Let me tell that story, and then we'll use that as an invitation to some time as we wish to share our own stories. As Francis knew the end was approaching and his health had been breaking down for several years, he asked to be carried through Assisi. So there was a sense in which a very human bond with his hometown, wanting to see all the familiar sights, though he was almost nearly blind, and so it was at best the silhouettes that he could make out, but simply being carried through the streets and a chance to hear the exchanges from the people of Assisi as he was carried by and to greet them one last time. There was a process in which the friars and the sisters of Poor Claire came through and he gave them a blessing. He blessed his community. He called for special goodbyes. There were people that he particularly wished to see and to say goodbye to in a much more personal way. There were some people in Assisi who came, who were sent for and who were brought to his deathbed. And he bid them goodbye. He was able to break bread and to have communion with a small circle of his closest colleagues and friends. He asked that the scripture from John chapter 13 be read, the story of the foot washing at the Last Supper. That particularly moved him. And then he asked that the brothers sing the canticle. And so they sang it through a number of times, and Francis himself joined in the singing. And one of his chief competitors or adversaries in the order was a brother named Elias. And Elias, so the story goes, actually rebuked Francis at this point and said, you should be approaching your death with fear and trembling, not with singing. And Francis, so the story goes, just laughed gently and continued singing. And so they just went around and around on the canticle and singing, particularly the last verse. He finished with a reading from Psalm 141. They continued singing, and the legend is that a flock of larks gathered on the rooftop and at the windows of the little house where Francis was, and were singing with them. Then near the end, he asked to have his cloak taken off, and he was laid naked on the ground, and they continued to sing and to celebrate, and I'm sure to mourn, and then he died. He died singing, apparently. So that was the story of, that's the story of Francis's own death and how he greeted death in life. I think about my own journey with death, and I was thinking about the loss of my first pet this morning when I had this beloved beagle named Punchy when I was 7, and he got run over, and I can remember just weeping almost violently, and then my dad and I throwing a softball back and forth playing pitch, and I was throwing that ball as hard as I could. I could remember, and then crying the whole time. And I remember how my dad and I acted out my loss, and how that was just a very powerful moment for me. I think of the encounters with death, and as a chaplain and as a pastor in hospitals and in performing funerals. I think of the encounter with death in Nicaragua of meeting and being with families that are ripped apart by the Contra and by folks that have been kidnapped and brutally tortured and murdered, and the experience of death in that. And I have a feeling that I still, the more and more I learn about death, the less I know. The more it seems like this opaque, impenetrable mystery, I'm convinced by life of its necessity, of its inevitability, and yet the more I'm grasped by that, the less I'm able to grasp what death means for me. It remains this opaque mystery for me. And I don't know if now there would be someone who would share a story or two about their encounter with this mystery that we call death, personal experiences, or whatever you would like or feel led to offer. Yes, sir.
Well, I think one observation, Stuart, is certainly from my perspective, is if there's a fear of death, or a concern, is that contrary to Francis, who knew it was coming and had adequate time to prepare and see people and say goodbye, sort of decide I was going to orchestrate his death on the basis of that story, is that the sudden death, where you go very quickly. So much of your business, so many of the goodbyes are unfinished. Of course, there's a lesson there if one is concerned about that, and that is to keep the goodbyes up to date, not to fail to say, I love you, I'm concerned about you, whatever there is in your personal relationship. So whenever it happens, and also your business affairs in our world today, to share within family of how we pay the bills and how we make things go and what would happen if I were gone or you were gone. But I guess at least for me, I won't speak for others. If there's some concern, I don't guess I really fear the thought of going beyond, because the promise is so great. That's what the faith is all about. If that isn't true, if there isn't life everlasting, then it's all a hoax. And I don't believe it's a hoax. But I think God said, I'd leave things undone. and that I lead people kind of in, particularly at my point in life, my wife. Sort of strengths that one I love the most, that I want to lead in comfort, and not physical comfort, but prepared.
I think the circumstances of death is often as troubling as death itself.
And I think of that, and particularly in my own, because my father died very, very suddenly at an early age. Just struck the family just without any warning. Job lived in 40-some years. She never truly recovered from it.
I kind of feel the assumption in myself of a long life, and that's certainly my intention. And that's certainly healthy, I think. I want to go out in a sense, screaming and kicking, because I love life, and we all love life. But there's also a sense in that if I repress the knowledge that I could go at any time, that my departure could be premature, then I can live life in such a way that I leave undone those things which need to be done, not at some future date, but now. And so repressing death, or being unwilling to encounter that reality as it walks with us through life, is to live in a way that's incomplete. Would someone else like to?
In relating to death as its experience in another culture, when I lived abroad for 19 years, I became very closely associated with people who were Hindu, Buddhist, or Muslim, and also Christian, and I worked among people there were very, very poor, and their approach to death is very, very different from our own. It's just it's a part of the whole cycle of life, death, and I think similar to where Francis was. But at death, immediately the same day, within a period of 10 to 12 hours. I was able to be with the people then who sorrowed and who then planted the body in a shroud in the earth. And these people lived in lived and worked on tea plantations, and they were very oppressed and disenfranchised, and they had no burial ground whatsoever other than in the midst of a tea field, but they could not harm any of the tea bushes. So they had to find a space within the tea bushes that was big enough in order to dig a hole that was 6-8 feet deep, and then to be able to plant the body there. One of these occasions I shall never, never forget is that we took the shroud up there, the body that was wrapped in the shroud, and only the men walked up to the place of burial, and the hole wasn't big enough. And so they had to place the body next to the pile of earth. And then two guys had to get down into the hole and dig it deeper. And while they were digging it deeper, lo and behold, here comes up a bone of some person who had been buried there previously.
Oh, dear.
And so one of the members of the Christian congregation says, "I think that was my grandfather." And it was just a matter of fact. And that was just a real, real, that was just something very different from what our experience here is.
You know, I think other traditions and other cultures can give us perspective on our own. And it strikes me that there's a profound ambivalence about death, or in the Christian tradition, and even in the way we read scripture, there's a sense in which we are at war with death. Death is the enemy. Death is to be resisted. And that's true in the sense of death-dealing systems in our world that oppress and dehumanize our fellow creatures. In that sense, we are to fight against death. There's another sense in which death is embraced as a gift in creation. And I think we've lost sight of that part of our tradition, the tradition of in Ecclesiastes, the tradition in the Old Testament of greeting death more like a sister than an enemy. And so we get that perspective on how almost matter-of-factly other cultures integrate that. Not without pain, not without loss, but it's not something unnatural in the way it feels with us sometimes.
Two comments. First of all, that when we look at the ecostructure, we can't do without death. The whole ecostructure is based on death. And it's very unnatural for us to pick our species and do everything we can to not die. And then when we do die, to, you know, make sure we don't disappear very fast. When you look at the way the whole created order is meant to work. The second comment is that I have a Jewish friend who was very close to her mother. She moved back from Boston to Milwaukee to work and live closer to her mother. And within a week or so, her mother was struck by a car and killed. And the worst thing for my friend Kathy is imagining her mother just lying there, I mean, embalmed and entombed and hermetically sealed and everything, but still in the cold of the ground forever. So while we have problems with our tradition, we still have this great promise that we don't have to, that sure the shell is there, but we are raised again.
Mm-hmm. That really struck me. I had a friend in college. Mm-hmm. We were running partners, and it was the fall. We had come back to third year together, and we had been running the previous year together, trying to build up our miles, and then we got together and decided we were going to try to do four, because we were both running during the summer. It was four times around campus, and we got around, we did the last loop, we decided to walk into the dorm where we started, and Becky was incredibly tired. She was just beat, and I was so elated that we had done 4 miles, especially for her, because that was a real feat for her to do. And I was just saying, Becky, you did it, you did 4 miles, that's such a great thing. And I was holding up her arms and telling her that she was a hero and everything. And we walked in and we were right in front of the dorm, and she had this huge smile on her face, just, yeah, I did it. And all of a sudden it left, and her body was weak, and she fell to the ground, and she died. She died right there, this healthy person. It was just intense. And the thing for me that struck me was that here we were, here and I were concentrating so much on our physical bodies, you know, like we're gonna get in shape, and we wanna look good, we're in college, you know, we wanna look beautiful, and all of a sudden, her physical body was lying on the ground. It was just a shell. I mean, her spirit, her soul had completely left it, and this person that was lying there was no longer Becky. I looked in her face, and it was completely lost of who she was. We concentrate so much on our outward appearance. We want to look good, and we think that's who we are. But what really is who we are is what's inside, and that spirit. And I actually experienced seeing that leave her, which was pretty incredible. It's
overlooked. I appreciate the way that folks are offering these stories, because I know that no one can talk about death without a great deal of emotion, and it means very personal things for us and our experiences.
My grandmother Olson taught me something when she died. She was a very faithful person, really kind of a mentor to me in my faith growing up, and she had arthritis very bad. She got it when she was 17. And finally, her last 25 years, she was in a wheelchair, and her hands were so bad that they had to powder them inside because they couldn't wash them. They were just so sort of gnarled. But this lady really loved life, and she hung on to it. And I thought if anyone could die peacefully, it would be her. But my mother told me that on the way to the hospital, she was still pleading, "Don't let me die, don't let me die." And I thought about that. You know, your first reaction is, well, gee, you know, where was her faith? But in thinking about that, I thought, no, I'm not so sure that's right. Because in another sense, at death, we really are reduced to perhaps life at its best, when all that we have is a simple faith, a trust in God. That's all there is. And we have that in Jesus Christ. And that's so much attuned, I think, to St. Francis.
I think, you know, I contrast kind of the Christian tradition in its approach to death, and the Greek tradition of the Stoic who like Socrates, meeting death in this kind of Stoic and control attitude of courage. And I think there's something, I admire that in a way, but I think I'm glad I'm in the Christian tradition where we have in Jesus the one who in his last hours in Gethsemane was pouring out his heart to God and saying, if there's any other way to bring about your kingdom, let it be, but not this way. Let me back away from this. And that's a tradition that I can own and feel I can bring my whole humanity to, the tradition of Jesus in Gethsemane. And I admire the Stoics, but they're not my community, I don't think. Would
you want? Well, I guess we need to share again the death of a dear friend of ours who took place between the time we left Minnesota and now. And Catherine mentioned at the Vespers the other night that this is an old gentleman that's been a friend of our, you know, for a long time. We went to visit him the day before we left. And I think most of us had the feeling that, you know, we would never see Oscar again. But yet here was a man that was 84. But, you know, he hadn't been able to get to church for a long time because he'd been bound by emphysema and lots of other ailments. But here was a man that was so strong in his faith. He was always a part of that church, whether he could be there or not. He lost his wife a couple of years ago. And, you know, I thought that was going to be the time when we'd lose Oscar, too, because they were such a pair for so many years that it was like he lost his life there at the same time. But he continued to struggle for a long time. There was a man that just, you know, kind of a curmudgeon, really. And the kids was, you know, they started running around church and he'd get after him, you know, but then a minute later out comes a piece of candy and he's there to kind of make the friends with him. And I think that's the kind of feeling that our kids have had with him for such a long time. And so you almost experience his death now vicariously because we were not able to be there. We heard about it a week after we left. One of our other members of the family came back and met us and indicated that, you know, he had died about 2 days after we had seen him. But, you know, I'm sure he had no fear of death because of his terrible close relationship with his Lord and Savior. As such, maybe he didn't welcome it, but he certainly did not fear it. And as such, I think we all can learn from people like that.
That's the wonderful thing about our tradition. I think it gives us resources that can offer us the ability to affirm and to accept death. At the same time, it affirms our inability to come to terms with it. It understands our fears. So it's both. It's strength in the midst of our humanity. It's not an impossible ideal of stoicism. On the other hand, it allows us to face death with the whole range of our human responses under the umbrella of faith, you know.
One of the things that has struck me is how often people who are dying know they are dying hang on until they can get permission from someone else. Like my sister last fall. Is it all right if I die?
So it really is a function of the community, of how death and dying are handled in communities. There's a letting go and a coming to peace, or holding on until you can.
And say goodbye to that.
Uh-huh. And yet, what is our experience often? When death happens, we seem to go to extremes. We either we're on top of people and giving them all the best wisdom we can come up with and making it very difficult just to experience the grief and the loss, or the opposite, we isolate and we're afraid because we don't know what to say, and there's nothing we can say. Just sometimes just being there. That was the quickest lesson that I had to learn as a chaplain in a ward, a cancer ward. You know, you don't. There's nothing you can say. There's nothing you can say. You simply are there, and your willingness to be there communicates something much more than.
Well, my father was very ill for many years before he died, and I lived a long way away, so I went to visit as often as I could. And I don't think I ever saw my father in the times that I visited him, even in sleep, with a look of peace on his face. But in death, finally, his face had relaxed and he looked at Jesus, which for me was comforting. Because when you have seen someone you love in pain and agony and hurting for at least 15 years, that's difficult to live with too. But to finally see that peace is very helpful. There is peace in death for some.
I also had an experience where my animal companion sort of taught me about death, and it also got me in touch with how really I hadn't encountered in my growing up time or after growing up time any kind of instruction in a grieving process, you know. It was the first time that I really went through a grieving process completely. And it felt like a real gift to me because it all happened so naturally. You know, I felt really fortunate in the way that things unfolded because, you know, it was like a gift that she gave me to experience, you know, my own way of grieving. And, you know, it's like she waited for me to come home. She was only 5 years old. She wasn't sick, she was perfectly healthy. And I came home at 10 o'clock one night, and she had just collapsed on the bed. After looking out the window, seeing me come up the walkway, she collapsed on the bed. And, you know, it was like, she can't be dead. She wasn't even sick, you know. And it just, I found that I was really able to open up, I think, the surprise and her willingness to wait for me so that I could really see that, wait, but, I mean, she was like still in the room. I could feel that presence. It's like, and she was still warm, she was still soft. And so I was able to take the rest of the evening to light a candle and to hold her body and to feel her life leaving. The rest of the physical things that happen, you know, in death, you know, to the point where her bowels let go. And it was really, really very moving and also it really allowed me to say goodbye to her, to sort of take a lot of time with really observing the death. And, you know, and I was able to share some of that with my partner, Patrick, and I think that, you know, it was a really enriching experience, you know, to be able to do that. And I just kept, you know, feeling a sense of gratitude in the way that it happened, because I could, you know, I'd envisioned all kinds of other ways, being hit by a car, or, you know, just, or getting sick for a really long time, and, you know, it just made me realize that there are a lot of ways that people and creatures live and die, and that it is a reality, you know, that we live with, and we never know when.
I think a good grieving process is such a gift and can deepen our integration of life, but not to grieve in the way that you have, not to go through that process through completion, I think is the number one cause of mental illness and mental anguish. I saw so many people in the mental hospital that where I worked who had grief experiences that were unresolved somewhere in their life. And no one goes through all these perfectly. It's hopefully something we learn as we go, but there's always the task to be willing and open to go back and finish grief or to work through grief again that is unfinished and to be present to that. Because it's natural that we would still continue to mourn loved ones throughout our lives. Mm-hmm. All right, back here and then across.
Well, this year my mother passed away, and she waited for me. I was in Seattle and she asked for me to come. She waited for me to be there and we spent the day together. And it was really, I really felt the gift of that, you know, for wanting to be there and kind of helping her to leave her body. She'd been in a lot of pain and really was looking awfully tortured. I had a similar experience of seeing her I wasn't there at the moment that she left her body, but right afterwards, and there was a lot of peace on her face. But I think one of the greatest gifts of that experience was that I think it was like the next day after she died, and at night I went to bed and I felt her presence, and she came to me, and I'm real sure that she did. And a lot of my fear had been that she'd been a person that had gone through a lot of torture in this life, and I wasn't, you know, there's always that fear. I was afraid for her. But I experienced her, I think, in the way that St. Francis talks about experiencing the soul, where she was purified, and she came to be purified, and all of the love that she felt for me was right there in the room with me. And it was so, it was just so affirming about death and life, that essence that we view in people is what we are and what we are left with. That it was amazing. I mean, I've just had so much peace since then. And it feels like the kind of thing that it's transformed me in a way. My willingness to want to be there for people when they're going through that process. And the recognition that, you know, it is definitely a part of, it's a giving up of a lot of the weight that we carry in this world. And it was really wonderful to have seen her afterwards.
Thank you. So part of the gift is what we hopefully pass on to the community and other, when other moments go, other people go through those times of loss and death and dying, that we know how to walk with them through that a little bit better, accompany them. Did you?
As a hospice nurse, I've had a chance to be with a lot of people through their dying, through their last days of life. And just what you were saying before about the grieving process is that for all of us, I think there's the phases that we go through at different times in our lives. And I had one young man who had died. I had worked with him for some time and had not met his family. His family was in another state. His mother and sister came to try to be with him in his last bit of time and didn't make it there in time. But they came to the ward and I met them at the desk and escorted them down to the room, and his mom looked at him and stood back and was very stoic and asked if she could touch him, if she could kiss him. And I said, yes, of course you can. And as she reached out to him, she started to weep for her mom. And that when her mom had died, that the nurses or whomever had told her that she could not touch the body, and that was all this unfinished work that had been with her for a period of like 20, 30 years, that she wasn't able to touch her mother, someone that she loved so dearly all that time. And and to have had that grief within her, but that was not a goodbye as she wanted to have a goodbye at that time. And the healing that was done during that period of whatever time they were in the room together, it was so wonderful to just be a part of that and to watch that go on and to hear the expression of the woman afterwards. And to really sense that that healing that goes on for us in different phases of our lives. It's just really a great thing. I think just that thing that we have a chance once again, you know, to heal what we need to.
I really appreciate what's been offered here, and it reaffirms for me what the best of the church can be. That men and women can gather and share about a reality that is pervasive in our lives, that we've all had very personal experiences with, that are very powerful, sometimes very painful, sometimes very joyful, sometimes both, but that we can talk about that, and that because we share a hope for life and for resurrection doesn't mean that we cannot then also share our humanity and our wrestling with that, in our encounter with the mystery that death still is. And I think is the more I live in the Christian hope of life, eternal life, and resurrection life, the more that hope becomes real to me, the more death becomes real, the mystery of death. And it's just that confidence and trust in Francis that I so admire, that he can befriend and greet and welcome this sister mystery, this sister death, and call her sister and befriend her. That is so powerful to me. Lisa, and then...
Okay. Well, I was going to say, just listening to everyone here, I somehow have come to the point in my own life where I've really been confronted by my own death, and it's just been very fearful and very scary for me. Somehow, I've lived through experiences of death, always with the Christian faith, but suddenly, for some reason, I've come to that point in my own life where I can see the end that I haven't really felt before. And it's just been very fearful for me and very scary, and it seems like all this Christian hope just doesn't cut it, so to speak. And I realized that from hearing that it's been a process of grieving for me, that I finally am realizing that I am mortal in a sense. And I guess I love life, and I sometimes have prayed, the spring is so beautiful, God let me live through another spring. But what I'm coming to sense is that it's not so much the promises, as it is I begin to experience God in my life here and now, that somehow I know I'm not going to be abandoned by God.
Yeah.
And it's not there completely, but that's what's been coming out of this, that knowing the love, and it's just hard. It's as if I had a metaphor just this summer of starlight was breaking through the darkness, and death seemed like a darkness and a void to me, but seeing the stars coming through the darkness, it was like somehow as if death was not all darkness and all void, there is light, and I'm getting more and more images of light breaking through the darkness. That's my image, but my sense is of God here with me now. God is not going to abandon me at death in some way.
There have been repeated moments in my faith journey in which all my intellectual convictions about life after death and all my sense of an emotional assurance about life beyond death have collapsed. And I think our community and our tradition are strong enough to embrace those moments and carry them along as part of our whole story and our whole journey, and to live through those moments to that basic conviction faith posture that is expressed in Paul's words, nothing in life or in death can separate me from the love of God. I honestly don't know what's going to happen after death. I don't even, I have feelings sometimes that that is the end, that I can't, there's nothing, it's so opaque and mysterious, I don't know what lies there. But I can say yes to it, I can affirm it, because I know nothing can separate me from God. I don't know what it is, but I say yes to it. I greet it as a sister, and still honor the mystery that it is, and honor the hope that is our tradition at the same time.
It seems like part of the getting to that place is the falling down and letting the doubt wash over you, because it's on the other side of that that you find faith beyond thinking.
Our tradition of hope is misused if it's used to repress our doubts at times and to extinguish our fears. We need to greet them as well and befriend them as well and listen to what they're saying and work through them and work with them.
And we need to be able to shout in anger at God too. You know, we have to accept it.
With Jesus, we can go out screaming and kicking, but we're still a part of the community of faith. The last word I want to say is, the ultimate message, I think, of the canticle is that our Christian hope is not for individual human souls, but for the whole of creation. The whole of creation groans for that life eternal and for communion with God. And it's the whole creation that is moving toward that final consummation. Creator and creation are one again. It's not just individual Christian souls that are going to pop out and go meet God. It's all of us, and that's what I think the beauty of the canticle is. So the child who, like myself, asks, will my beagle go to heaven? The answer, I think, is yes.